Blog Talk Radio. This is Love's Outer Limits, and I'm your host, Dr. Amy Marsh, sexologist, hypnotist, lots of other kinds of things, and I'm with my co-host, M. Christian, otherwise known as Chris, erotica writer, sexuality writer, sexual futurist, and also lots of all kinds of other things. We've got a great show lined up for you today, so welcome. Hey, good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm all right. It's it's an odd new world, and I'm sort of navigating this interesting time the way everybody else is, I guess. But we're here today to talk about unusual kinks that we don't hear that much about. But before we do, happy birthday to you.
Aww.
I'm going to embarrass you on the air by telling you that, but I hope it's a good day for you.
Thank you very much. That means a lot to me.
Okay. All right. Well, it means something to me, too. A lot, I should say that. Saying something makes it sound minimized, and it's not. Before, I guess, we get started, let's do our shout-outs. Since it's your birthday, do you want to go first?
Certainly. I mean, I know we have a we've done it many times before, but I think it's always worth mentioning the wonderful folks at Tickle Life, who not only have wonderful articles by certain people, meaning you and I, but they also have been so generous in giving us a lot of support for this wonderful podcast. And personally, I want to give a shout out to Kinkley, because they've been publishing quite a bit of my articles. And one of my favorite ones, of course, is futureofsex.net. But, you know, it's just, I think more than anything, it's like a shout out to all you people who are like dealing as well as they can in these, you know, challenging and stressful times, and just hang in there. We'll get through it.
Yeah. Great message. Absolutely. And that's absolutely all we can do, really. Well, I guess I'll bring up my favorite shout out, and I'm so glad that you started with Tickle Life. They're really good to us. They have a page where our podcast can be listened to and accessed through one of their pages at Tickle Life, and you can find the links in our show notes. And then, as always, Disasterina's AIDS Life Cycle sponsorship page. There's a link to that. I don't know if the AIDS Life Cycle event will still go on. I presume it will, but you know, right now it seems like everything can be, you know, is liable to be canceled, but I still think it's worth sponsoring this, because the money raised, all of it, will go to the AIDS, San Francisco AIDS Foundation, and the LA LGBTQ Center, and it's for AIDS prevention and treatment. So do sponsor if you've got a little bit of spare cash. So, yeah, and here we are. So, you want to? We've got so many. The sexual buffet table for human beings is so vast, and there's so many things that could be sampled on it. And some of those are classified as fetishes. And is that a useful term or not? I don't know, but people can be sexually aroused and attracted to pretty much almost everything. Now, of course, that's not true for every single individual, but speaking as a sexologist, looking at the big, big picture, yeah. So what should we talk about first? I know we've got a few topics we've discussed.
You know, I'm not too sure how to start. I mean, it's such a big subject. And, you know, I do think it's important, like you just said, to be very straight about that. I mean, straight, I mean, you know, focused that, you know, all as long as it's consensual, as long as it's not causing harm, you know, any kind of sexual interest or, you know, thing that excites you is perfectly valid. And, you know, it's important, I think, to sort of recognize that. And, you know, it's like, it's funny, but it's like sometimes the terminology kind of like makes me a little uncomfortable when they talk about like alternative sexuality or something. Sometimes like there is no such thing, because it's like, you know, there's no such thing as normal. So there can't be really an alternative or, you know, an unusual or something similar. But, you know, I think some of them deserve a little bit more recognition, and some of them I find quite exciting or fascinating.
Absolutely, yeah. And just for the benefit of our listeners who may be tiny bit confused, remember on this show we are only talking about consensual acts involving adults. So, period. Mm-hmm. Adult humans, or maybe, you know, objects or supernatural figures or whatever, but definitely when we're speaking about humans, it's adults. And I just want people to understand that coming in. So then we can speak freely and talk about all the other cool things that are out there without somebody getting confused.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree that terminology can be problematic sometimes. It can make people feel maybe a little ashamed or guilty, or as if there's something wrong with them. And I think that's always unfortunate. I believe in honoring adult consensual sexuality, sexual expression, and behavior of pretty much any kind. And this isn't for people to talk themselves into, I think somebody's consented when they actually haven't. You know, sometimes people can be mm-hmm. a little self-serving that way, a little bit delusional. But with those kinds of disclaimers given, I think one of the interesting things that you and I were talking about the other day was that your experiences as an erotic writer and a sexuality writer of writing about different kinks, and you were talking about sort of the difficulties and the challenges of doing that. Would you like to address that?
Certainly. Yes, it's like you're thank you very much for that sweet compliment. I mean, it's like, yeah, I've been erotica writer for a while, and I've written all kinds of things, and I still do, though over the last couple of years I've been focusing more and more on nonfiction, but I'm still trying to get my hand in fiction. But, you know, it's like little things that when you're a writer, you kind of like take the jobs as they come. And don't get me wrong, I particularly love, you know, writing, and I'll write about anything with a sense of enjoyment, and particularly about sex, which I find very enlightening and quite a bit of fun. But, you know, it's like many things, it's like when involving, like, you know, BDSM, in other words, power exchange, you know, whips and chains, to be, you know, vernacular. I always find it to be pretty, you know, pretty smooth going. But when it comes to, like, more narrowly focused sexual interests, and we should talk about fetishes at one point, because that's kind of a weird word, but, you know, like, just to give you a quick example, I got an assignment to write for a magazine specializing in legs and leg fetishes, and I found it particularly interesting because I'm normally used to writing just about sex as a generality, and maybe with some more things, particularly, you know, like same-sex attraction or, like I said, BDSM. But in the case of this project, it was kind of challenging because they had a very, very specific focus and a very specific restriction on terminologies and descriptions. And it was an enlightening experience, but it was a little difficult because I don't have that particular interest. And it was really kind of interesting to try and, like, have to use certain words or focus on certain acts that I immediately, frankly, didn't understand. It was still, like I said, a particularly interest, but it was a little challenging at points.
Well, can you share some examples of the specific terminology?
Well, one thing I know particularly was they said when describing feet, because it was like feet and legs, when describing feet, to describe them using words like, and they gave me a list, and one particularly that sticks in my mind was shrimp.
Shrimp.
They also said to talk about, exactly, and to talk about smells. And so it was really quite interesting to get this window into this particular segment of sexual arousal. But yeah, it was like smells. It was describing toes as shrimp-like. I think it had words like shapely or strong. It was particularly interesting. I mean, I would use a lot of these words myself, but they said put emphasis on it. So, of course, you know, being, you know, the noble hack that I am, of course I did, but.
Interesting. Wow. I wonder for someone who likes, you know, who's aroused by the idea of toes as shrimps, I wonder if there's also an arousal with eating shrimp. Who knows? It's, you know, my mind went to food, I guess. and there are really interesting associations that sometimes people make between their specific fetish. I mean, let's talk about fetishes first. I think those are, you know, definitely part of the, you know, the kinks, you know, this is that big, big umbrella term. But yeah, I think I'm getting the feeling from what you're saying that there's coded language. And say, for example, if, I don't know, come have a, you know, shrimp cocktail at my house. Could that be perceived as an invitation for foot fetish play? I don't know. You tell me if you've ever heard of that, because I'd be quite interested to know about that. Yeah. Any other examples that come to mind about fetishes that you've written about where you've been aware of a specific vocabulary or way of presenting things for readers?
Well, I think that's pretty much like the limit of my fetishistic writing, even though I've definitely probably touched a bit. I did write a story about puppy play, and that was particularly fun to do. For those who don't know, puppy play is, how do you describe this? It's kind of almost a BDSM branch, or can be BDSM branch, of furries, where people assume the persona of an animal, usually a dog, but there's other animals as well. And so a puppy play scene might be involved, you know, something like, you know, playing fetch. It could be, you know, with some BDSM elements. It could be eating from a bowl, all that kind of thing. And you know, that was particularly fun. Of course, I kind of cheated because I basically just wrote a story that was, you know, basically about describing a man's relationship with a dog, but of course the dog was anthropomorphic and had arms and legs and such. But but yeah, it's, I find this really very fun and very fun to explore. And you know, to be honest, it's like sometimes I find myself like engaging in, you know, just kind of like looking and exploring all the different branches of human sexuality, even though I may not particularly have that interest myself, just because I think it's just absolutely wonderful that we now can find ways to connect with other people and share and build communities around these things.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And when I was writing a weekly column for Carnal Nation, I actually did get into some fetishes, and they were really fun. And some of the examples of things I'd written about were the aquaphilia, so, you know, sexy attraction to water, and there's many ways that that manifests, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Sexy vampire thing, let's see, people who sell and buy used underwear. That's, you know, pretty famous one. Actually, it even made it into Orange is the New Black when a bunch of the women in the prison were producing and then selling in an underground way used panties to earn money, which, you know, it tickled me no end, really. Let's see. Vampires, I already mentioned. Oh, very, very, very large breasts. And these were either actual breasts or women wearing what looks like gigantic party balloons in their shirts. And and then, of course, associated or a subset of that is, you know, kind of a lactation fetish, a milk fetish. I mean, there's so many things. It's really phenomenal, actually. I mean, we're just adding a couple of things here out of probably thousands, really. I know some people have attempted to do encyclopedias of such things, but even those are not complete. They just scratch the surface of what people can be into.
Absolutely. And we talked last night, too, about size fetishists.
People
who are attracted to, like for instance, I had a recent assignment writing about various kink conventions and events around the country, and one that we highlighted was SizeCon, which I'm not too sure when it takes place. I can look it up, but if you just type in SizeCon into Google, it'll pop right up, which is a convention dedicated to enthusiasts of size fetish play, and that can be anything from gigantism, you know, in men and women. It could be, you know, being consumed by a giant. It could be expansion or inflation fetishes, people who, like, really find, you know, the idea of a person enlarging, speaking of, like, breasts and such, you know, like, you know, a woman's breasts becoming huge in, you know. So it's like, I love the fact that not only does it exist, but it exists in so many different types, you know, because you can't just say that that's, you know, size fetishes or a certain type, because there's like all kinds of different, you know, subdivisions and so forth. But they have a convention every year, which I think is just absolutely wonderful.
Where does it take place? Do you remember?
I can find out really quickly here. Let's see.
Oh, okay.
Nothing more boring than looking
you...
at someone looking up on Google.
That's okay. While you're doing that, I'm thinking, oh, where?
Let's see. It takes place. It's already taking place this year. It's in February, and it's in Piscataway, I think, New Jersey.
Interesting. Right.
Piscataway
okay.
Is.
I don't know because
Piscataway,
I've never been to New Jersey, but yeah, somebody here listening to us probably has. I'm thinking of pop culture figures like the Incredible Hulk, and you know, like somebody somewhere is getting off on that. The old science fiction movie Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
I particularly like the fact that when I looked at the schedule for SizeCon, they were going to have a special screening of Ant-Man and the Wasp. And I thought, oh my God, that's a perfect movie for someone who has a size, you know, a size fetish, because it's like, it's got everything in there. It's got gigantism. It's got, you know, being diminished. It's got, you know, sexuality. It's just like, oh my God, that's a perfect movie for it. But that was particularly delightful. But yeah, it's just like, I mean, and that's not the only one. I mean, there's like, you name the interest, and there's either a web page or a hashtag or, like I said, an event, and, you know, even clubs, you know, that specialize in particular sexual interests. I just think it's absolutely fascinating.
It makes me wonder, you know, the people who really need that community and want to gather with others who have similar interests, you know, this is, of course, a tough time for them as well. I'm looking at the copy of the column I wrote about aquaphilia and noticing that a man named Phil Bolton apparently coined the term and created an Aquaphiles Journal of Underwater Erotica in the 1990s. This was online. And then there was somebody, apparently Dr. Corinne Lamberth, who is an English therapist, but they refer to her as elusive. I'm not sure why. Wrote a paper on the psychology of aquaphilia. And the Aquaphiles Journal apparently published a copy of it. But, you know, there is a subset of erotic literature that is sort of bogus case studies that aren't real, but they are meant to titillate, but in a sort of underhanded way. So I'd be interested, since this person's referred to as elusive, I'd be interested to find out if this was a fictitious case study or actual research. But with the aquaphiles, there's so many subsets, like either people in the water, clothed or nude, the idea of clothing and shoes being ruined by water, doing sex acts in water, a fetish for people in wet clothing, so sort of wet look. There's like swimming fully clothed, which is actually something I used to do with some friends when I was a teenager. We thought we were too cool to own bathing suits. This was in the 60s. And so we'd go swimming every day during the summer in our jeans and a t-shirt. Like, we just thought we were hip. I don't think there was any fetish activity around it. But for all we knew, there could have been somebody up on the cliff with binoculars, you know, having a good time with that. Would have never known. So fetishes can be around appearances, behaviors, substances, objects, precise scenarios, I think could be termed fetishes in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
Let's think of a few. Let's do a little brainstorming about things that we can think of here.
One that came to mind is, you know, and this is, again, it's like, you know, sometimes it's like, it's interesting. It's like, sometimes I always wonder if there's kind of a bridge between fetish and sexual orientation. In other words, that, you know, I mean, you know, the delineation is attraction and arousal. So In some ways, fetishes can be considered a form of orientation if it takes to a point where your arousal is dependent or amplified by a certain, like you said, action or something similar. You know, one of the ones that came to mind particularly was, you know, age play, you know, can be, you know, both, you know, an activity. And age play, for those who are listening, it's important to delineate when we talk about this because, unfortunately, a lot of people don't understand this. But age play is consensual adults who are assuming an age that is not their normal chronological age. I shouldn't say normal, but their chronological age. Now, age play can be wearing diapers and being an infant to adolescence. So it really is a whole span of, you know, of assuming or playing with an age that you're not. It never involves anyone who's actually underage. I have to be very clear about that. But, you know, age play, you know, can involve a lot of ritualized activity. It can involve sensory. It can involve all kinds of scenarios. I knew a couple people in the way back when who were practicing age play, and they were extremely, you know, focused on this and, you know, had like customized clothing made, backstories for their characters, and really just put a lot of wonderful work into this, where they would have parties and there'd be a headmistress and something similar. And I just, once again, I keep repeating myself, but I found it absolutely fascinating because it's like, you know, here's somebody who recognizes their sexuality and then, you know, has, you know, the wherewithal and the wonderful resources to like manifest it. So I thought it was absolutely wonderful.
So were both these people, I'm curious, were they both playing ages that were younger than their actual chronological age? And they would have to seek out for, well, you mentioned a headmistress, for example. So they would have to seek out other people to be in older supervisory capacities or, you know, or parental capacities.
Exactly. And it was interesting. I found that in some cases, people would assume a character or a persona, kind of very much like a role play, that is actually younger than themselves. And it could be alternative gendered. In other words, you know, a boy, you know, who's forced to wear female clothing or something similar. Or in some cases, they would actually create a persona that is actually themselves, but just an alternative self that has, you know, feminine or younger qualities like clothing or behavior or something similar. It was very, very, I mean, that's what's so great about this is like, you know, there's no limit beyond consensuality of, you know, being able to create this alternative self. And I attended a couple of parties and, you know, they would do, you know, very child things. I mean, it wasn't, you know, overtly sexual at all where, you know, things like pin the tail on the donkey, you know, playing with toys, you know, all this kind of stuff. And there was also subdivisions that do more like corporal punishment you know, that kind of thing. So pretty much anything goes, once again, as long as it's consensual.
Right, yeah. I just want to make a note, too, that when you're being a puppy or some kind of animal, you can also be a different gender of some kind as well. So people will mm-hmm. often gender switch in puppy or pony play, for example. Those aren't the only two animals, of course, but mm-hmm. they are two animals that can be involved in sort of training scenes. So there's dressage for the pony play, you know, which very formal trotting and appearances and presentation. You know, not everybody does that with pony play, but that can be part of it. And of course, with a puppy or a dog, you know, you want them to follow your commands to sit and beg and roll over and, you know, be on guard or whatever it is that you've worked out with your, you know, human animal companion. Or your human animal companion has conveyed to you. Yeah, it's really interesting. I'm sorry, I'm getting rather hoarse right now.
Cool. Well, one thing I had a delightful experience one time. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say, so I had a delightful experience attending a kink convention one time. And, you know, I think it's particularly really fun that, you know, depending on the kink convention, because like any other kind of sexual interest, you can't just say there is a standard or a normal for anything, let alone software. So, but I'm starting to see in kink BDSM conventions a really very, I think, you know, wonderful recognition and support of other branches. Like, for instance, it's becoming common to go to a kink convention and finding there'll be a age play, you know, segment, you know, maybe like a ball pit or something similar. And one time I went to an event and they had a whole pony exhibition, including a race and, you know, like judging and blue ribbons for the best ponies. And, you know, it was just really quite lovely.
I'm really impressed by the fact that imagination is so much a part of these kinds of things. I feel in some ways that grown-ups in this Western consumer culture, they don't have that many opportunities unless they're a creative person who produces things through their imagination. People don't get to play enough. And mm-hmm. I think it's quite natural that as, you know, as an adult, that some of that play would be eroticized. But when I watched my children grow up and I saw how absolutely important imagination games were to them, and how these kids would just immerse themselves in a scenario and they'd kind of talk through it. So there would be this dialogue going about, well, then I did this, and then I went to the castle, and then I crossed the moat, and then you were over there with the sword. And in some ways, I've got to say, some of the kinky and BDSM scenarios remind me of that, because,
mm-hmm.
and that seems to be a really deep human need, whether it's eroticized or not, and a whole lot of fun. And, you know, speaking of fun, there's a few fetishes that fascinate me, partly because I have a bit of an erotic charge to them myself. Loving clowns, coulrophilia,
mm-hmm.
is fascinating to me. For me, it's not all clowns. It's only certain types of clowns. And it also kind of blends over into certain types of makeup that present an alternative personality. But like an ordinary Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey type clown, not so much. For me, they have to be a little dark, but not so dark as the clowns that are known for being like serial killers in movies. You know, I'm somewhere in between. And I don't know if it's, I've never gotten to explore this, but I don't know if it's being with somebody who's taken on this different persona and appearance, or if it also involves me doing the same thing. I sense that it might be that way because I'm very also drawn to kind of cabaret and vaudeville and burlesque and drag. You know, these are things that just cause me immense delight, and they seem related in some way to this idea of clowns. But that's huge. I mean, there are groups on FetLife. There are groups on Reddit. You can find gazillion images. If you Google our search engine, coulrophilia, that stuff comes up right away, including bands like Gooferman. I think more well-known as Insane Clown Posse. I don't really like them so much. I like Gooferman. I don't know. It's that kind of carnival, clown, circus, anything can happen, you know, transgressive kind of edge. There could be a little bit of mockery of authority. I don't know. It all is kind of mixed up in something that I can't quite sort out. And I also don't know when it began or why. And I think that might be the case for a lot of people too. Whatever their fetish is, they may not know exactly why they've got this attraction or this desire to play in those realms. And I think people have... I'll finish my sentence. Sorry. I paused there, so I know you thought you could jump in and that I was done. But I think in the past and sometimes even currently, psychologists and sexologists have attempted to describe the mechanism by, you know, how this can emerge. But I don't think it's as neat and as pat as any systems that people have come up with. Okay, I'm done on that one.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm sorry for jumping in there, but I completely agree. It's like, you know, sometimes it's the connection to how a, you know, a particular sexual interest or fetish emerges is very kind of clear and people are aware of it. In fact, I've always been kind of a little secretly jealous because it's like, it must be wonderful to know exactly what turns you on and then have a community that supports it. And, you know, because, you know, I have to admit, I'm kind of scattershot. There's certain things I like, and I'm too shy to really bring it up, which is odd for someone who's as public as I am. There is a couple things that I consider myself to have sort of a quasi-fetish. And it kind of dovetails to what you're talking about, because like you mentioned before about, you know, that performance and thing. It's like when I was a young kid, we used to go to the Renaissance Fair in Los Angeles. And if anybody went to the Renaissance Fair around that time knows, it was a very erotically charged environment. First of all, there's cleavage for days. So I've always had kind of a lure to like eroticized events or environments. So things like, you know, I've never been to Burning Man, but I've always imagined Burning Man's kind of like my utopia for this. I've just simply, you know, I don't like hot weather, so I've never gone. So, you know, and same way, it's like I find myself drawn to like fetish fashion, but not necessarily fetish play. So things like latex, vinyl, you know, like tech wear, which is the new, you know, one of the new fads around this kind of thing, I find very alluring. Because once it's kind of bold. But yeah, it's interesting how these things can sometimes you know where they come from, other times you have absolutely no clue. So, you know, it's just like, and frankly, it's like, I don't think we need to know unless it's damaging, unless it's something that actually is getting in the way of you, you know, having a, you know, a good life or, you know, once again, hitting on attitude of consent. But, you know, it's like, at the same time, I do find myself particularly fascinated by it. And particularly, it's like, in some ways, I wish it'd be kind of fun we could give ourselves, you know, a certain fetish or, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what's so great about the world we live in right now, aside from the weirdness that's surrounding us right now, is we have all kinds of researches to explore. And you touched on that when you talked about play. It's like, you know, it's like, once again, it's like, I wish the message would get out there that unless it's harming someone, unless it's non-consensual, whatever you're into is fine and take time to indulge and, you know, look online and see what you might like. And if you don't like it, big whoop. If you do like it, well, cool.
Yeah, exactly. So a spirit of tolerance, acceptance, forbearance. Absolutely. I was thinking a moment ago while we were discussing this idea of, well, how does something get started? I do know that among my clients, there have occasionally been stories where somebody had a clear set of experiences, often as an adolescent, where they were, you know, stealing their mother's underwear out of the dirty laundry, for example, and feeling very furtive and guilty about that. And something about the furtiveness and the guilt became part of the attraction and the appeal of, you know, of the fetish. And for some people, that was okay. and other people found themselves disturbed by this. Probably if they hadn't been afraid of being found out or being told, maybe they were raised in an environment where they would have gotten into major trouble, or they were told that they were sinning, you know, maybe it wouldn't have been that troubling to them. You know, maybe they would have had sort of the charge of adventure, but not so much the shame. But it's interesting sometimes too how shame and guilt can become mixed up in these different erotic activities. So it's not like the play is always, you know, lighthearted, good, clean fun. You know, we're dealing with all kinds of things going on in a person's erotic world. But I still think if we start from the spirit of forbearance, tolerance, and acceptance, and, you know, ranging to gleeful celebration, we're better off, you know, rather have people enjoy themselves than feel guilty about it, for sure. Let's talk about some of the other things that have come across our paths. You've gone to a lot of events, and you've just talked about enjoying erotically charged events. So when you went to different conventions or play parties, I'm assuming that that was fun for you, even in and of itself, regardless of what you were actually doing. Would that be a fair thing to wonder?
It would. It would. I mean, I haven't gone for one for quite a while, not because of the whole situation with the pandemic, but I still find them very fascinating, and erotically charging, even if I'm particularly not into what's going on. You know, some things particularly, you know, have sort of like imprinted a little bit more than others. And, you know, I've been to several events where I just felt like it was such a wonderful experience. And part of it is kind of like a liberation. I've always been kind of what I describe as a stimulus junkie. In other words, I find myself like, you know, needing stimulation. So being in an environment that I find stimulating, particularly erotically stimulating, kind of hits a very primordial button. So I particularly find myself, you know, attracted and having fun during those kind of things. But, you know, it's like, really I like it because it's like, it's kind of like, once again, it's kind of like living in a porn movie, to be kind of like, you know, trivial about it, where, you know, everywhere you look, there's something interesting going on. And so it's very, you know, stimulating that one. There's also kind of like this wonderful sense of potential. So even though, you know, I would never, of course, do anything without consent, you know, it's kind of interesting to look around like a party or an event or Folsom Street Fair or, you know, Gay Day or, you know, or some kind of kink event and just think like, oh, my God, the world is full of potential. And who knows, if I ask politely, if I negotiate and I get consent, who knows what could happen. And even though often I'm too shy to actually do anything, it was kind of like that really kind of like potentiality that I find very, very, you know, very charging. So, you know, things like Folsom Street Fair, which unfortunately now that I've moved outside the state, I won't be able to go into it for a long time. You know, I find always very wonderful. And like I said, I've never been to Burning Man, but I imagine that's very similar. You know, but, you know, for me, that's like, I like that. Also, it's odd. I mean, we're getting way into my psychology here. I like feeling a sense, kind of a double-edged sword. Like I like feeling otherness. I particularly like experiencing something like, for instance, Folsom Street, because it feels so different. It feels like this is almost a different planet. And, you know, that's why I like to travel, though sometimes I do suffer a little bit from isolation, and I can only do it for so long, particularly in a culture where I don't know the language. But, you know, I just, once again, it's like it's interesting how these things emerge. And, you know, I'm not too sure really. Oh, I mean, it's just like, it's one of those things. It's like, I'm never too sure. It's like, if I really want to know where it came from, I know certain things about my sexuality, where it comes from. And like you touched on, it's like, sometimes it comes from something that's kind of dark, something that was problematic, a symptom of something that was, you know, to put a spin on it, unpleasant. In other situations, it's something that feels very light and freeing. So it's really kind of hard to like sort of pin it down.
Right, right. And I don't think we need to necessarily, as you said earlier, unless it's, you know, really troubling and something needs to be addressed there. But I think one of the things that I've noticed is that people in this, you know, Western consumer culture, there's not a lot of permission or attention given to the idea that exploring our own erotic nature, our inner nature, is something that's important to do. You know, it's kind of like sexuality is presented in the mainstream as, you know, this pretty basic physical series of movements that are done and, you know, somehow love or affection are attached to it for the most part. Mm-hmm. And going deep, you know, into, well, what actually does get me turned on, or what is a squick, a turnoff for me? Where have I responded at different times in my life, and why did that one thing work with one person but not another? You know, this is a fascinating area of self-discovery. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to have a partner or partners who do that too, then wow, yay, you know, that's great. But, or hopefully it's great. At least it's got that potential, you know, that you just talked about. And liberation, I can definitely relate to that feeling of, you know, it's like you're claiming agency and territory and validating things, even if it's just validating and claiming the ability to be an explorer and to be able to go walk around and mm-hmm. look and see and find and discover. And as a sexologist, you know, who's gone through formal training, which included a lot of exposure to, so much different types of erotica and porn, you know, which was, you know, erotology was part of our curriculum. I really did have the sense, and still do have the sense of exploration and discovery. And it feels rich and good and deep to be able to understand these things about other people or myself. You know, I will talk about one of the programs that was offered during my training was a sexual attitude restructuring program. So they're referred to as SARS. Sometimes it's now called a sexual attitude reassessment program. And this is really important training for anybody who's working in sex therapy or sex counseling and sex education. And sometimes the SARS are a weekend, sometimes they're longer. The one at the place where I went to school was 8 days. And so there would be panel discussions, there'd be films, there'd be experiential type events, all sorts of things that was basically throwing us in the deep end of human sexuality. But one of the high points of that whole program was what was called the fuckorama. And we were basically in a room where I don't know how many different projection devices were running, but at least three walls were full of slides and films and stills and who knows, of illustrating just about anything, everything. You didn't know where to look. So there would be people rubbing cake on each other on a beach on one panel, and then it would be a classic BDSM flogging scene from the 40s, and then it would be an orgy scene over there, or it would be a masturbation or somebody drinking urine. And you know, it's just like, wow, okay, people do this. And I could find a lot of wonder in that, and also a certain amount of humor. Like one of my papers that I wrote during that time was a sexologist's letter to Jane Austen talking about watching a film of a young man drinking another man's urine out of a cup. It was a riot to write that paper. I had a lot of fun with it. I think my instructor enjoyed it, but I wasn't making fun of this activity, but I was playing with it in my mind and different ways of perceiving it. And for some reason, mm-hmm. that's liberating too. And there's a kind of, I don't know, I guess humor is sexy to me and intelligence is sexy to me. And it's always fun to be able to bring that into this kind of exploration. And now I am wandering way too far into my own psychology here. So, you know, please excuse me. But let's talk about food. Let's talk about food fetishes for a bit, you know.
Food fetishes is huge.
Yeah. So, we've you know, I've seen footage of the people, you know, smearing cake on each other on a beach, which seems a little weird because the cake frosting got sandy. People will often use different foods and lick them off their lovers' bodies. Let's see, mm-hmm. what else can we talk about with food?
Food is a huge thing. I mean, it's like, I can't tell you the number of times that's like, I've been like, you know, like, it's funny. It's like you hang out with enough kinky people, meaning people in the BDSM world, and you hang out long enough and someone is going to bring up the idea of a fancy dinner where, uh-huh. like, the servers are submissives and, you know, but it's not just any fancy dinner. They want to have a high-class, very sensuality-focused dinner. So I think there's, like, a very primordial thing there. One, food is very tactile. It's sensual. It tastes, you know, it's very sexual. And then, of course, you have the ritual, you know, that you have, like, the power dynamic of server and being mm-hmm. served. And then you have, like, you know, the cultural associations. I mean, oysters, of course, being seen as an aphrodisiac and all this kind of stuff. And I can't remember the Japanese term for when they have a nude woman and, you know, she acts as a sushi platter. I mean, you know, sex and food is, right. you know, forever interchanged. I mean, there's a famous French film, Grand Bouffe, where it's like, you know, these jaded men are going to basically screw and eat themselves to death. So it's like some triumphant of erotic fetishistic behavior. You know, so it's like, it's such a primordial thing. I mean, it's just like, oh my God, I mean, just watch the Hannibal TV show. And I agree, they're talking about cannibalism here, but it's so sensual and so sexual. It's like almost delightfully disturbing.
Yeah, got it. That's not a program I've been able to watch or move to watch, but I do have a strong desire to attend a kinky tea party where the mm-hmm. People who are identifying as women, dominant women, are being served by servers who are delivering impeccable manners and training. Trays of beautiful gluten-free goodies and nice hot steaming cups of tea in fine china. I swear this has been a dream of mine, but the kinky tea party scene in San Francisco ended just as I was about to be able to partake of it. And I was also, I mean, just so sorry to miss that scene, really, because I'm like super geeky about tea and tea, afternoon tea. So I kind of have a, yeah, I can feel that erotic charge with food through the tea party thing, definitely, mm-hmm. or a really super good meal. I mean, let's face it, but in these times of social distancing, we can only dream, unfortunately, at this point, when even going to the grocery store to get a bar of chocolate is a perilous action. You know, I think we're all going to be leading very rich internal fantasy lives at this point. You had
that's interesting.
Me
it's like,
go ahead. Where, no. You.
Well, I was gonna say, it's like I think I'd be very curious to see what fetishes now emerge during this period. I mean, think about
it.
It's like people are practicing social distancing, so that means they have a lot of time on their hands. And of course, most of us, you know, are blessed by having the internet. So I really wonder, it's like, I bet you that when this is over, or you know, at least diminished, we're going to see a boom in interest and attendance for kink events. Because, once again, people are bored. They're going to spend time looking on the internet and suddenly discover they like a certain thing. And, oh my God, the internet loves that kind of thing. So I'd be very interested in that. It's like, you know, I also wonder, it's like, how is this going to change human sexuality? That's a whole subject for a whole different podcast. But,
yeah,
you know, it's like
absolutely.
There's a potential for creating a lot of fetishes and a lot of particular sexual interests. And on a side note, by the way, you're talking about, you know, high tea and so forth. And I have to say that I'm particularly disappointed for many reasons that poor Anthony Bourdain passed away, but not to sound selfish, but he had planned at one point in the future to create a Blade Runner themed, you know,
Oh my God, really?
City, and you know, for a techno fetishist like myself, I was like, oh my God, please, you know. And unfortunately, like I said, he passed, so it's not going to happen. But that always sits in the back of my mind as far as like the combination of, you know, my particular fetishes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, maybe when all this is, you know, over and people can be in proximity again. Maybe we just have to create some events. I'm sure there's going to be an uptick in medical play, wouldn't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe not. Maybe everybody will be so freaked out. I'm not sure how that'll play. It'll be interesting to see if that emerges.
I wonder if face masks will suddenly become an erotic accessory.
Well, you know, it already is for some people, which actually squicks me, because as a person with environmental illness who has had to at times wear masks in public, everything from a cartridge respirator to, you know, a less bulky mask, for me, those are symbols of despair and isolation and, you know, a signal that I am not able to be in the world in the way that other people are. So for me, it's a super negative thing, but I'm sure for other people, it will be fetishized if, you know, and there are some people who fetishize this already. I mean, I've seen fetish wear with gas masks, and I'm sure you have too. you know, it's, gosh, you know, let's get together and play, you know, virus decontamination. I mean, who knows what's going to go on here? Let's see. We've only got, we've got about 9 minutes left on our show. What have we not covered that we thought about covering when we had some conversations and planning? Did we leave anything out?
I think we covered a lot of it. In fact, we covered a couple of things. I think they're particularly fascinating. Yeah, we talked about water. We talked about size. We talked about food. But again, there's like all these different branches and, you know, all these different styles and all these different, you know, and, you know, the one thing I want to say really quickly before we wind up here, it's like, you know, again, I mean, maybe I'm repeating myself here, but it's just like, you know, be kind to yourself. I mean, just because you find something particularly arousingly charged, as long as it's consensual, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. Feel free to indulge it. I mean, now more than ever, it's time for some self-exploration. So take some time and look on the internet and find things you like. And if you don't like them, then no big deal. If you do like it, then it could add something very important to your sexual spectrum. I mean, you know, once again, it's like as long as it's consensual, there's nothing wrong with it. And our culture, unfortunately, loves to isolate people. It loves to punish people for what it considers to be outside the norm. And again, there's no such thing as normal. It does not exist. So take the time and have fun. And like you said before, play, you know, have fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And a better word for normal is average or usual, you know, because it's, you know, we can say there is a bulk of people in this world who are probably only doing, you know, pretty straightforward sex acts. But, and that would be an average. But it doesn't mean that things that are beyond that are abnormal. They're just not as usual as some of these other things that take place, you know, sex for reproduction and so on. So, you know, so the message for our listeners is, you know, whether you're seeking financial domination or you've got a hair fetish or whatever it is you're into, you know, don't beat yourself up, as you said. Use some common sense, you know. For example, if you're into being financially dominated, set aside a portion of your earnings so that you don't get super taken to the cleaners. You know, have your little play fund and don't go beyond it. You know, just use a little common sense if you can. I know for some people it's super exciting, but, you know, there's the rent still to be paid. If you're into latex, if you're into whatever it is you're into, dressing like a furry animal, you know, I echo you, Chris, like just go for it. Have fun with it. Don't feel bad about it. Hopefully you'll be able to find some partners, if you want partners, to be with you in this exploration. And, you know, don't worry too much about whatever it is, you know, as long as it's not hurting anybody who's not an adult human. Okay. I think I've said my piece. I don't know if I have anything else to say at this point. What should we wind up with? Anything else that we've got?
I just think, you know, taking care of yourself during these troubling times. I mean, that's probably the biggest thing, I think, is just, you know, again, this is scary. We need to admit that it's scary, and there's nothing wrong with reaching out to help. You know, reach out to friends, reach out to community, go on social media. Everybody is feeling very scared and very anxious right now. So, you know, practicing self-care is extremely important, and that could be anything from indulging, once again, in, you know, sex, you know, fun, or it could be watching cartoons, it could be catching up on your reading, it could be anything, but please be gentle with yourself, and we will get through this. This is not, I mean, yes, things will change, and maybe even change for the better, but we will get through this, and we are a resilient little species, you know?
Yeah, it's not so much the species I'm worried about, though. I mean, you know this. I'm worried about the individuals, but, you know, that's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
So all we can do, really, is look out for ourselves. And if we're on lockdown with members of family or roommates or friends or lovers, you know, then we look out for each other, too. Yeah, you know, self-care of whatever kind. You know, this is the mantra right now. Going inwardly, cleaning your house, whatever it takes to get through the day and the night and to, you know, stay in some kind of good mental health as much as you can. So I think with that, we'll see you next week. We're going to talk about sex and magic, and that should be an interesting topic. It's one I'm really interested in. So, So, Chris, I'll say goodbye to you, and we'll be talking soon, and happy birthday again. And to all the rest of you, please take care, and we'll see you next week. All right, bye-bye. Let's see. I want to bring in our music here. There we go. All right.